Welcome back to the program. You know, today with 24-hour news, with our high unemployment, the shrillness of our social and political discourse, it sometimes feels as if we're all suffering from a kind of collective OCD. We're fearful and often paralyzed, and at the very least, tempered in our actions by the specter of fear. Yet at the height of the Depression, Roosevelt said that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Our current president came to office promising hope and talking about hope, the opposite of fear. And yet, perhaps because it's in our collective culture, our collective DNA, or simply for the personal and political gain of some, fear has once again been infused into our collective consciousness. We're going to talk about that today with a guest that has been with us before. It is a pleasure to have him back. He is Rabbi Harold Kushner. He is the Rabbi Laureate of Temple Israel in Natick, Massachusetts. He's the author of the classic work, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. It is my pleasure to have him here today to talk about his new book, Conquering Fear, Living Boldly in an Uncertain World. Rabbi Harold Kushner, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, good morning, and it's a pleasure to talk to you, Jeff.
Great to have you back here. Is there something about fear that is interwoven somehow in our collective consciousness in this country?
Oh, I think it goes deeper than that. I think there is a sense of fear which made it possible for our ancestors to survive primitive society. I mean, if they didn't learn to tell the difference between the dangerous animals and the animals that could be domesticated, if they didn't learn to tell the difference between fire that cooks their meat and fire that could have burnt their house down, we would never have survived. A certain level of fear is fine. Somebody asked me the other day if we thought maybe we could eliminate all fear, and I said, you know, if a doctor would come up with a vaccine that would protect us against ever being afraid, I would urge people not to take it.
Mm-hmm.
We need a certain level of vigilance. But then, and you sort of alluded to this in your introduction, I think very accurately, you get to a point where we are so afraid that it distorts our judgment. We become harder to be creative, harder to be imaginative. We become very self-centered, focused solely on survival. I've read, for example, that in a plane crash where there's a possibility of getting out alive, more than 90% of the passengers get out alive. And the ones who don't are the ones who panic, who can't remember where is the exit, who can't decide, should I go back for my luggage? Should I take my shoes off or leave them on? They stand there paralyzed, and they're the ones who get left behind.
Somebody once said, I don't remember who it was, that they lived through many tragedies in their lives, and some of them actually happened.
Yes, I think there was Mark Twain, whom I quote in the frontispiece of my book, as saying the goal should not be the absence of fear, but the mastery of fear. Yeah, pretty perceptive guy, old Mark Twain.
Indeed. The sense today of fear is exaggerated in so many respects by the fact that there is so much information from so many different places coming at us all the time that feeds into that fear instinct.
Well, far be it from me to be one who criticizes all the radio and TV for giving us news. But yeah, there's a lot happening in the world that if we didn't know about it, we would be just fine. You know, there's a kidnapping in Milwaukee someplace, and the 24-hour news services play it up hour after hour until we begin to feel that kids are being kidnapped everywhere all over the country. Yeah, that exaggerates things. But at the same time, you know what I think is going on? I think there's a sense of on the part of a lot of people that events in their lives, events affecting their lives, are out of their
control, right.
And that leads to fear. You know, can you picture yourself driving a car down a highway and all of a sudden your brakes don't work? This is absolute panic time. And that's what happens when you think things are out of control. People look at politics, people look at economics, people look at their financial situation, their job prospects, they look at the world their kids are growing up in, and they have the sense that things are out of control. I suspect one of the causes of the religious revival, of extreme religion, I shouldn't say extreme, that's a judgment, highly conservative religion, the old-time fundamentalist religion, is the sense of wanting to go back to a world where you just knew what was right and what was wrong and who was good and who was bad. And the sense of confusion, whether it's gay rights or gay marriage or the way some people talk or the way some people behave or the kind of movies they're making. People of my generation, I'm going to be 75 in a few months, I can understand why they would feel that things are getting away from them. And that sense of out-of-controlness very often leads to fear.
beyond the fear leading to the kind of paralysis that we were talking about earlier, it also leads oftentimes to a kind of aggression and anger, which we see playing out in many respects in our society.
Jeff, that is a very good insight, and I commend you for it. Anger, Jeff, is what men do with their fear. Do you realize that? Expressing fear is unmanly. So when a man doesn't want to appear afraid, he channels it into anger. It's why people get into fights in bars. It's why a lot of things escalate like that. Yeah, but the scratch the anger and you will find fear underneath it. And I think examine the fear more closely, and I suspect you will find a sense that events are getting out of control, and you have to find a way of asserting control over them.
And how can we start to look for ways, or at least look for personal mechanisms, by which we can begin to channel this fear into more productive outlets?
It depends what the situation is. Sometimes what you need to deal with fear is simply more information. The more doctors tell you about the procedure, the more in control you feel about it. The more, when you're hospitalized, the more nurses ask you what you would like to have done, which one first, what time, the more in control you feel. Sometimes just information and the sense of being involved. Sometimes what you need, I found, for example, writing the book, and this surprised me. When I sat down to write the book, I thought the biggest, most troubling fears to deal with would be the fear of serious illness and death. I mean, what's scarier than that? I learned there is something scarier than that, and that is the fear of rejection. Rejection destroys people more than serious illness does. Illness, people rally around you. There are things you can do. There are all kinds of responses. When you've been rejected, when you've been laid off at work, and there's a lot of it going on in my congregation, I've got a couple of dozen people capable, highly regarded, well-paid people till a few months ago who've been laid off. When you're rejected in a romantic relationship, when your husband walks out on you, when your girlfriend says it's just not working out, that is absolutely devastating because you're getting the message, there's nothing special about you, we don't need you. And people can't live like that. People have a real need to feel appreciated. And at a time like that, what calms the fear that rejection defines you as a person of no meaning, of no value, you need people who reflect a better sense back to you. At times when I've been very depressed, as a teenager because a girl had rejected me, as an adult because I didn't get a job I'd applied for, what pulled me out of it were friends who just realized I needed a friendly face to talk to, took me out to dinner, chatted with me, told me some jokes. It didn't change my situation, but gave me the sense that I was a person worth caring about, and that's what I really needed.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the only antidote for fear is to look outside yourself to the force that I call God. I don't care what terminology people use, but there is a source in the universe that gives you the courage you need when you need it. How do people cope with incredibly challenging situations? You ask them, and they'll say, I never believed I could do it until the day I had to do it.
There's also the sense in which that fear is being exploited by individuals for their own advantage.
Oh, you better believe it. I mean, look what happens in a typical election campaign. Next time we're in one, check the ratio of how many ads extol the virtues of one candidate and how many ads warn us of the terrible things that will happen when the other candidate is chosen. Without wanting to get into the politics of it, look at what's happening with the health care debate. I mean, people are extrapolating from a 400-and-some-odd page bill the idea that just because the government wants to reimburse doctors for talking to you about whether to pull the plug on grandma, they've come up with this whole concept of death panels, which is totally out of their imagination. It is not in anybody's bill, but they're using it to scare people. The idea of people, you know, the Glenn Becks of the world who scream socialized medicine, and the people who follow them and say, government, stay out of Medicare, stay out of socialized medicine, but don't do anything to my Medicare, which is, of course, socialized medicine. If God were to ask me how he could have made a better human being, I would have said, could you make the rational side of us a little bit stronger than the emotional side, so that we were not so easily manipulated by emotional appeals to fear and to things like that. By the way, Jeff, you know this this coming season is my anniversary. It was 20 years ago at this time that I was in the San Francisco earthquake.
One of the things that we see, and the healthcare debate is an interesting example, and perhaps in this we can learn something more about fear, is that fear generally does one of two things. It either brings out the best in people or the worst in people. And to the extent that it does sometimes bring out the best, what can we learn about how better to deal with it?
Well, a technique that I very often use when people tell me they have to deal with something and they're afraid they're not up to it, I will say to them, can you think back to a time when you were asked to do something and you thought it was too hard for you, but you had to do it, and it worked out? Take that as a confidence builder. You've done this sort of thing once, you were fine, you were up to it, and it worked out. And then I'll say, and can you think of a time in your life where you had to do something hard and it didn't work out? You gave it your best shot and it just wasn't enough. And what happened? You didn't feel like a failure. You felt forgiven. The real alternatives, I tell people, are not between success and failure. They're between success and forgiveness. There are no losers here unless you are so paralyzed by the fear that you mess up. Go in with the confidence that either you're going to do it or you will fail nobly. And trust me, you will feel much better for having tried and failed than for having chickened out and not even tried it at all.
What do we need to do to teach our children in a more effective way to not succumb to the kind of fear we're talking about?
That's tricky because it depends on the reality of the fear. I want young children to be taught to be suspicious of somebody who says, will you get into my car, or your mother told me to pick you up and take you for dinner, or would you help me find my lost puppy? We need to teach them to be afraid of certain things, to be careful when they rollerboard or whatever. But I think if we become hovering parents, we give children the unspoken message that this world is really too dangerous for them. Do you know, Jeff, that to this day, and I'm almost 75 years old, I cannot ride a bicycle because I grew up in Brooklyn, and my parents were afraid that their beloved, brilliant, promising son was going to be hit by a car and crippled, or else just fall off the bike and break a leg or something. They communicated their fear to me, and how many decades later, I haven't entirely gotten over it.
Talk about the things that, the fears that you've dealt with over the years and how you've tried to overcome them.
I think the scariest thing was finding out when our child was so sick and my wife and I really weren't sure if we were adequate to the task of taking care of a seriously ill child. But we loved him so much that we just said, look, we're going to give it our best shot. And if we don't always do the right thing, we will know and he will know that we made mistakes out of love and not out of selfishness or malice or lack of concern for him. And that's exactly what happened. Other times that I had to deal with fears, sometimes I responded in a typically male way and said, I'm going to brazen through this by myself. And sometimes I was mature enough to ask for help. And when I asked for help, a lot of difficult situations became a lot more manageable. I would have to lead a congregational group on a trip to Israel, for example, and there were just so many details to take care of and things to check in advance and things to follow up. And it was driving me crazy. And finally, one of the members of the group said, you know, we could do some of these things for you. You don't have to be a rabbi to call ahead to the hotel. And I said, thank you. Thank you. You really made this a lot livable. And they felt more of a sense of ownership of what's going on. So at times where I felt overwhelmed, times I wasn't sure I was up to it, sometimes I handled it right, sometimes I handled it wrong, and I would like to think I learned from my mistakes.
One of the things you talk about in conquering fear is the value of maturity and of really understanding from the perspective of age what fear really means.
Yeah, in retrospect, you look back. I mean, one of the things I have said to people, for example, let's say in my congregation I got a call from a family that one of the members of their family had just been taken seriously ill and they were in the hospital, and I would rush to be there, and I'd sit there in the waiting room, and while we were waiting for the doctor to come out and tell us what was going on, what I would say to them is, can you remember what you were worried about 1 week ago today? No, tomorrow's problems come along and chase yesterday's problems out of our minds. a lot of the things that we're terribly concerned about, a lot of things we're afraid of, turn out to be fairly insignificant. Either they happen or they don't happen. And if they happen or they don't happen, you still survive. I think the experience of finding out, and maybe this is the most important lesson of all, finding out that you can blow it and the world doesn't end. You can make a serious mistake and people don't die. You can really get something wrong, hurt somebody's feelings, make somebody feel neglected, and you're worried that they will never speak to you again, but there is forgiveness in the world. And if somebody is stubborn, and if, you know, if one of your listeners were to call up and say, hey, that rabbi doesn't know what he's talking about, I hurt somebody's feelings, a neighbor at a party, and they haven't spoken to me since, bottom line is, they don't want to be forgiving, that's their problem. Let them walk around with the burden of carrying all that that bitterness. You know that by apologizing for your mistake, learning from it, you did the right thing. That's all you need to know.
What impact does the rapidity of events today, the speed of change, the speed of all of our lives, have on what we've been talking about?
That's a good question. Obviously, if you have to make a decision faster, one of my closest friends is an attorney. He was one of the first people I know to have a fax machine in his office. I mean, right now, fax machines seem like a relic of the past.
Right.
But he got the fax machine, and he said he hates it. He hates it because if somebody faxes him something that needs a legal response, he feels an obligation to sit down and get the answer out right away and fax the person back. When he got a letter, the letter could sit on his desk for 24 hours while he thought about it, and then he could come up with a much wiser and much more measured response. So that sometimes the pressure of events to respond right away works against us, because the immediate rushed response, it's wonderful to get an email back within minutes after you ask a question, but you might be getting a better answer if the person had the ability and the leisure to think about it overnight. So I think the pressure of instant communication, people who can't go for an hour or so without checking their emails and their BlackBerries, I think that pushes us into making a lot of unwise decisions because we're in such a hurry to make them.
Of course, those decisions also build on each other over time, and there's a broader long-term consequence of all of it.
Well, I think there are a couple of consequences. First of all, that all these things sort of pile up. A lot more gets done, probably a third of which we could have survived never having done. And the rest just wears us out. To be on all the time, I think that's why the Bible prescribes a Sabbath, and why one of the things that has kept me sane has been that no matter how tense things are around me, I just shut down from Friday night to Saturday night.
One of the other fears that you talk about, and certainly it is so much a part of our culture today, is the fear of change. And that seems to permeate so much of our society and so many people so often.
Yeah, it's a generational thing, for one thing. The example I use is I got a new cell phone about 3 weeks ago, and I had to ask my grandson to program it for me because it baffles me. And he does it in seconds. And when the book was ready to go into production, and my editor said, can you send us the manuscript electronically on a disk, I had to call my grandson, and I asked him, how do I do it? He says, I'll be right over. And I said, no, you don't have to come over. Just tell me. So he wouldn't understand. I'll be right over to do it. Yeah, the result is my generation, parents, grandparents, feel like immigrants in a world that only young people understand. We don't speak the language. We don't understand the rules. I don't mind. I admire my grandson for being so knowledgeable and so willing to help. But there's a part of me that says, whoa, just a minute. Knowledge is supposed to flow from the older to the younger. I mean, that's virtually the definition of education. And when it has to bubble up from young people teaching old people how to do things, it's not just a matter of pride. It's a matter of the idea that they may be reluctant to accept our guidance in other areas, because we seem so inept about the things, the cell phones and the text messaging and the computers and the programming and the other things in their world that are just so foreign to us. I think that's one of the things driving people back to traditional religion. I think it's one of the things driving people back to be very suspicious of some of the social changes, whether it's the role of women or the rights of gays or the welcoming of minorities. Things that say the world in which we grew up and we're so comfortable is being taken away from us by people who are not like us. And that makes people very fearful and very angry.
To the extent that we are questioning that in the context of, you know, that old quote, where's the wisdom that we've lost in knowledge? To what extent can we begin to address that and how?
I don't know. It concerns me that so many things, as I get older, so many things in society are trending younger. Younger people are being given more responsibility because they're seen as bringing a fresh perspective and a certain technological knowledge. And that's fine as long as there is a respect for older people. Do you recognize the name of Daniel Goleman, who wrote a book on social intelligence and emotional intelligence? Bright guy. He tells a story in his most recent book about how his widowed mother retired from college teaching and decided to make one of the rooms in her home available rent-free to a college student just to have another person in the house in case, God forbid, something happened to her. And she would give preference to Asian American students because they come out of a culture where age is revered. One of the things we can do is, as a community, vote in favor of more respect for old people because that's where we are all headed. With the longevity revolution, with people living longer, it's only self-interest. It's not a matter of charity for us to vote in favor of, let's be more open to the wisdom of older people because one day I will be an older person and I want people to listen to me. I'm urging old people to stop being annoyed by the liveliness and sexuality of the young because they don't have it anymore. And I'm urging young people to stop resenting the old because they walk slowly and drive slowly and think slowly. And recognize, for all of us to recognize what this other group can add to our lives because we'll all be enriched by it. We will all be old people one day. You know, if you look at the commandment in the Ten Commandments, honor your father and mother, read the whole verse. It says, honor your father and mother that your days may be long upon the earth. Now, being kind and honorable to your parents so that they'll have a happy old age, that makes sense. But how will it give me a happy old age? Because I want to create a society in which older people will be treated with honor. And one day I hope to be a citizen of that society.
And of course, as you point out, fear of aging is what prevents that sometimes on the part of young people.
Absolutely. Our society is so biased in favor of the attractive and the productive. And as you become less attractive and less productive, you're valued less. But that's starting to change. And it's starting to change for a very simple reason. The baby boomers, born between 1946, 1962 approximately, they are starting to grow old. They are the generation that at every stage of their life, there were so many of them that economic interest hovered over them and said, what do you want? We want to sell it to you. When they were teenagers, the culture was all about making teenagers happy, movies, music, disco. When they were young adults, we reinvented and rediscovered the station wagon, and all the TV shows were about young adults. When they got into middle age, all the books on the bestseller list were about midlife crisis. Now, you don't think it's a coincidence that just as that generation is starting to turn mid-60s, healthcare reform, which has been on the agenda since Harry Truman was president, is suddenly getting a lot of traction because this massive population cohort, with all the votes and all the dollars they represent, they're coming of age when this is meaningful to them.
Rabbi Harold Kushner, the book is Conquering Fear, Living Boldly in an Uncertain World, just out from Knopf. I thank you so much for being with us today.
Jeff, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for the interest.